It's been a while.
It's been a while.
Spring really took over our lives with all of our other projects as we predicted, but we were not completely aware of how much that would be the case. So we're going to try to get back in it and not have as big a break the next time and just stay more on pace, but probably still not as fast as it was at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. We're doing our best. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I will say that because it has been so long, wow, I've probably listened to the audiobook version of this chapter 50 times at this point. Yeah. Like, that's one thing is I would be like, all right, okay, it's time to get ready again.
Yeah, because we have the audiobook. And yeah, even if we're not finding the time to actually like sit down with the chapter and take notes and actually prepare the episode in a proper way, we can at least squeeze in like listening to the audiobook while we're doing this, that, or the other thing. And then so it ends up when there's a long time between chapters, between recording sessions, we can have listened to the audiobook chapter so many times.
Oh my gosh, a lot. Yeah. I feel like I really, really got this one down.
I'm like lip syncing it along with the reader.
Yeah. And starting to affect a British accent when I talk about
it. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I would say, too, it's one thing that's kind of cool is that, or one thing that's interesting about this time period where we've been listening to it a lot but haven't actually been recording is we've actually had so many conversations about this chapter at this point.
Uh-huh.
So I'm hoping that we can keep some of those sparks alive that we've had.
Right.
These little embers that we've been holding through the month and bring some of that back today because we've had some generative conversations for sure about this chapter, which, for the record, is chapter 5, Many Seasons Ago, Why Canadian Foragers Kept Slaves and Their Californian Neighbors Didn't, or The Problem with, quote, Modes of Production.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
For a title. Yeah, right. So this chapter comes right on the heels of the chapter about free people and the origin of cultures that included a bunch of examples that were meant to show the diversity that can exist within the category of forager.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like not all foragers are nomadic game hunters, right? And we had the really prominent example of the Calusa from Florida, who were kind of like a coastal kingdom, very wealthy, very stratified hierarchical property relations, you know. And in this chapter, the Davids are building on that, extending it kind of further in a way where they hope once again to rescue human agency, like historical agency, from what they perceive to be the forms of determinism that they find to be so prevalent in anthropology, like environmental determinism, where a culture is kind of like forced into the form that it takes and the politics that it expresses by its like environmental factors, you know, like whether they had a rich or a poor like resource base, like whether it was coastal, like whether they were nomads or sedentary or like whatever stuff, like basically kind of determines all the rest, you know, is the way that they rightly or wrongly, you know, see a lot of anthropology to be constituted.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is like in large part a project of, you know, making a case for human agency, right? And so what we have in this chapter is basically like an extended case study that is meant to show that there's other ways that cultures can end up the way that they are, that cultural features develop that are not these like environmentally determinist or other types of ways that like arise from maybe material conditions, right?
Yeah, because they think that there are factors that are ignored or tend to be downplayed by anthropologists and archaeologists too, who are creating stories about longer term time or prehistorical time.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that there are a large array of cultural features that don't seem to tidally fit into the deterministic explanations or into the evolutionary theories of social organization.
Right, yeah.
And so they're wanting to find those and highlight them and give examples that trouble those ways of explaining how humans organize.
Yeah, yeah. Or like they want to give a different account.
Yeah.
They want to theorize a different account of why maybe a particular culture is the way that it is. And there is a very specific mechanism of cultural differentiation that they're proposing here in this chapter, and we'll get to that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But for the whole of this chapter, we're going to the Pacific coast of Turtle Island. One of the cool things about this chapter is that, like, maybe more than any of the chapters we've encountered so far, we are really, like, getting into ethnography.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is a very anthropological chapter in the sense of, like, we're talking about and comparing different people's life ways,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they have a theory, you know, and we're weighing different theories and stuff. So it's pretty satisfying in that way. But yeah, they start the chapter by pointing out that, like, basically from what's now around the southern coast of California, around Los Angeles, all the way up to Alaska,
mm-hmm.
was at the time of European, you know, colonization and settlement, was possibly the largest concentration of foraging people in mm-hmm. the world.
Mm-hmm. You know?
The coastal people, particularly, but even folks that live in the Central Valley in California and all this stuff too, none of these people farmed for staple foods.
Mm-hmm.
And their population densities were actually quite high.
Yeah.
The natural resources, so to speak, that they subsisted off of, from the aquatic resources of the coast and the rivers and the nut-bearing trees like the famous acorns in California, were so substantial that, you know, it supported like high population densities, so that from top to bottom, or like from north to south, you know, these were all foraging people. Some of them quite sedentary,
mm-hmm.
and some of them more nomadic or semi-nomadic, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of cultural diversity within this sphere, mm-hmm. you know? But that sphere is the focus of the book.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, and also, I just want to point out here that even that existence of this intensified foraging, or we might rather say wild tending,
mm-hmm.
and food and plant management, like animal and plant management practices or something, if you want to sound, make it sound more technical, wild tending yeah. sounds more relational.
Yeah.
Then to understand that these were folks who were living not very far from pretty large agricultural cultures.
Yeah.
Because to the east of the southern coastal peoples, there was the people of the Great Basin and of the southwest of Turtle Island, who all had extensive agricultural practices with beans and maize and squash.
Yep.
You know, and they were close enough that people would have encountered each other. You know, that's part of the point of this, is that
mm-hmm.
the Davids are always wanting to point out that if people live within a few days' walk or journey within each other, they knew of each other's practices.
Or even a few weeks, yeah.
Yeah, that's probably true too, yeah, right. And so they knew about it. And in fact, maybe you were already going to say this, but these coastal peoples that we're speaking of did grow, they did have some cultivation practices besides the wild tending, because a lot of those different groups were growing plants for sacred purposes or for ritual purposes, like tobacco or like silver leaf, potentilla. They had plants that they cultivated and moved around with them and planted by seed.
Right.
So it's not like they didn't know how.
Yeah, right. And that's important here, partially because, like, you know, from a evolutionist type of standpoint,
mm-hmm.
these folks who didn't farm could maybe be talked about in such a way, like, where it's like, oh, they hadn't adopted farming yet.
Right.
Right. Or maybe like the technologies of farming hadn't reached them yet.
Totally.
You know, this would be like a very, I mean, kind of like a very common way for non-agricultural people to be talked about.
Right.
You know, it's the idea that agriculture is the wave, you know, that's coming. These people are on very fertile, you know, the especially California. I mean, but I think really all of this territory, but, you know, California is famously fertile soils for agriculture. It's not that the terrain like didn't support it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like Kalahari desert people or whatever that don't really have an option about farming. But the knee-jerk evolutionist framing would be that these people were kind of like behind,
mm-hmm.
right? And what the Davids, you know, are pointing out, and I think they say this explicitly in the chapter, is that they're like, these folks weren't just non-agricultural, they were maybe anti-agricultural.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know? Like, because they could, they had everything they needed to
right.
adopt agriculture. They knew, like, they had hung out with people who were agricultural for sure.
Mm-hmm.
They knew that people were doing it right, not that far away.
Mm-hmm.
They maybe had even tasted the fruits of agriculture, you know, I mean, like literally corn and squash and stuff. And they did cultivate tobacco and some other crops, maybe not crops, but
they had special plants.
But they had gardens
yeah.
where they cultivated plants that were important to them, but they still didn't farm, you know,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is kind of, there's a little bit of like a preview of the whole idea of the chapter in general, is that like
mm-hmm.
these people, perhaps they chose not to,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right, right, right.
Graeber and Wengrow are, they want to give space to the idea that this was like a conscious refusal,
mm-hmm.
right? And I mean, of course, like we could always say, oh yeah, well, this was like a refusal that was like enabled by,
right.
you know, very rich, wild, natural foodstuffs that they could, you know,
mm-hmm.
and sure, you know, right, but still.
But given that resource and context, the level of resources and the context of the climate, all the different microclimates, they're part of what's so amazing about California is there's this really wide array of different little microclimates, and which means you can have variety in your diet.
Yeah.
And right. especially if you move around, you know, mm-hmm. that as you're wild tending, you could be like, let's go to this place now and go do this thing.
Right.
And subsist on this food and have the life that's around this particular plant community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that seems to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, they had the precondition for more choice in some ways.
Yeah, 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 right. But there's no reason to think that agriculture wouldn't have been successful for them.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
So the question kind of arises, like, why didn't they adopt it?
Right.
You know? So with this as the entryway, they kind of open up the question of like cultural differentiation
mm-hmm.
in general.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually quite a few pages towards the beginning of the chapter where they kind of, you know, in just a few pages give like a synopsis of the way that the discipline of anthropology has like thought about
yeah.
cultural differentiation over time.
Mm-hmm.
Like over time as in like the different phases of the discipline of anthropology. And, you know, by cultural differentiation, we mean this exact question is like, why are people different from each other?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like, how do differences arise?
Mm-hmm.
And like, what do they mean? Where do they come from and what do they mean? And, you know, as you can imagine, this is like a pretty basic question.
Yeah.
In anthropology, like, you know, if you really want to get kind of meta, it's one thing to study like one culture at a time and be like, this is how things are here. This is how things are over here. This is how things are over here. But then if you step back
mm-hmm.
and then it's like, well, how, you know, how do ideas spread or fail to spread? Or like, why don't the people of the world just have one religious belief system
mm-hmm.
that, you know, was figured out from a very early time and has just like been the cosmology of all the people,
right?
Right? Why not? And at this point, the authors take a bit of a detour into the concept of language,
mm-hmm.
or not just the concept of language, but, you know, but the fact that the people of the world speak different languages,
mm-hmm.
right? And that the languages can and have been traced back, you know, like the languages of the earth are grouped into language families, you know, including the languages of indigenous people to Turtle Island, and you can kind of make a family tree of languages, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are like lineages, and, you know, they talk a little bit about the like original Proto-Indo-European language that is the ancestor of a lot of like the European languages, as well as Sanskrit and mm-hmm. Semitic, if yeah. I'm not mistaken, you know, right? So there's a lot of study there. And sometimes within anthropology comes this kind of, you know, assumption or whatever that that culture spreads along with
language.
Language.
Right.
Right. And one term for a culture in anthropology would be like an ethnolinguistic group.
Oh, right.
You know, they yeah. like use this term ethnolinguistic.
Mm-hmm.
Ethno meaning like cultural
mm-hmm.
and like of a people, and then like linguistic, like these are tied. The language is tied to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so in theory, you could kind of propose that culture sticks with the language and where people are migrating and moving around, speaking their language and evolving their language family tree will come their cultures, their food ways,
mm-hmm.
their religious practices, and the other elements that we think of as cultural, their political practices, you know. But Graeber and Wengro, it's kind of interesting, like they're like, this idea that mm-hmm. culture and language kind of go together might actually have more to do with the modern European conception of the nation
right.
and the nation state. It mm-hmm. might be like actually an artifact of the nation state.
Mm-hmm.
Because now, I mean, it's a relatively new idea
mm-hmm.
that we think of like, you know, the French, and like the French are French-speaking people who have these certain cultural features, and they have a certain territorial
mm-hmm.
bond with a certain territory, and it's all kind of one thing,
mm-hmm.
where it's like the language, the land, the people, the culture, the manners, the like all this stuff. And then you're like, yes, and the French are like related to these other people who also speak a related language, you know, and then so you really see the tree. But the authors are quick to point out that actually, when you look at, say, the indigenous cultures of Turtle Island as they existed pre-contact, let's say, then what you actually see is people who speak very different languages
mm-hmm.
from totally different language families
mm-hmm.
being close neighbors of each other and having very similar cultural features to each
right.
other.
Right.
You know, so their like religious practices might be very similar. Their food ways might be very similar. Their political organizations might be very similar. Their mode of life in lots of different ways could be very similar to each other, which is maybe not surprising because they're living in the same kind of region or like the bioregion mm-hmm. or something, which has an influence, right, on how culture forms. And they're also the neighbors of each other. But they think of themselves as very different people
mm-hmm.
and speak totally unrelated languages.
Right.
You know, so there's this like non-equivalence of like, you know, you actually can't predict cultural features to adhere to linguistic family trees
mm-hmm.
very well. Actually, geographic proximity
mm-hmm.
is actually a better predictor
mm-hmm.
of cultural similarity than whether the language you speak is related to another person's language.
I guess a good example of that that people might be more familiar with is like the Finnish similarities to the other Scandinavian, to the Scandinavian cultures of Norway or Sweden.
Oh, right.
When Finnish is an entirely different language.
Not an Indo-European language at all. Right.
Actually
right.
quite an outlier
mm-hmm.
in language world, mm-hmm. but pretty similar culturally
right.
to those other places. Right.
Yeah, totally. And like what the Davids do find is that language does seem to correspond with like your identity,
mm-hmm.
you know,
so
you actually identify as being kind of related with people who speak a similar language to you,
mm.
you know, so there's like a personal identification piece that does follow more closely with the language, but other cultural features like food ways and modes of subsistence and even like religious ceremonies and things like that do not.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And it makes sense if you think about it because language is so much of a determining factor in how we think
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
how we express ourselves and are able to perceive and how we name our perceptions and are even in our brain once we have language.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense to me that people with specific language ways would perceive themselves as associated with that thought pattern and that way of organizing.
Right. Yeah, right. I think I know what you mean. Like, kind of in that way where what your language is in a certain way determines how you think.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they determine each other, I guess.
Right.
Kind of like they're in like a reciprocal determination. Yeah.
Yeah, so that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So kind of following from this, one way that anthropologists have historically classified or grouped indigenous people is by geography.
Right.
By like region, you know. And what we're saying here is like rather than just by like language group.
Or by more like evolutionary classifications.
Or by or by evolutionary classification.
Because that was another trend for a while. Yeah.
Right.
Because they actually give examples of that of being like early savages, later barbarism. Like there was apparently at some point in both anthropology and also in the curation of artifacts, a trend in actually presenting things as an evolutionary story.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. But one way of like grouping cultures together, if you want the members of the group to be like somewhat similar to one another, you know, is to group them according to geographical like region. Because it turns out that people who live in geographic proximity to one another will generally share a lot of cultural traits. But, you know, as we'll get into like later in the chapter, you know,
and there's important
there's exceptions. Always a lot of differences, not just the languages that they speak, but there's always a lot of other differences as well. So this is what was called in anthropology, like the culture areas, you know, and there's a map in the book on, I don't remember exactly which page, that shows Turtle Island getting like carved up anthropologically into just a handful of culture areas. Like there's the Eastern Woodlands, the Plains, the Great Basin, or I think they call it the Plateau, but it looks like the Great Basin to me. The Southwest, you know, and then the Pacific Coast, right?
It's 169.
169 in the book. And one big advocate of the culture area way of framing things was Franz Boas.
He's a pretty famous anthropologist.
Yeah, one of the most famous anthropologists who has probably already come up in the book.
Yeah.
But Franz Boas, I might have just learned from reading this book, is actually responsible for the pretty old school anthropological wing of the Museum of Natural History.
In New York.
That is in New York City, right? So the Museum of Natural History that's right off of Central Park, there's a series of rooms that are these kind of, they seem kind of antique and kind of dated, like, whoa, like these haven't been updated in a long time.
They honestly seem a little dusty.
Yeah.
They seemed like they could use cleaning when we were there.
Yeah.
It was a while ago.
It's not a modern museum experience. And some of like the signage feels kind of icky.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
And I remember kind of going through that feeling like my hackles were up a little bit and I didn't spend a whole lot of time in there. But this is not to denigrate Franz Boas. In fact, like one of the reasons why he was into the culture area's idea is that it didn't rank people.
Right.
You know, it was just like, these are the people who lived over here. These are the people who like lived over here. It wasn't organizing people by their stage on the evolutionary ladder or like anything like that. He was, according to the Davids, at least a staunch anti-racist.
Right.
And, you know, he was into the leveling.
Well, and I just wanted to add that it was interesting for me to learn that he was responsible for those exhibits, or at least that collection. And like, there's a pretty famous canoe that's hanging in the...
Right. The Kwakiutl War Canoe. That's maybe one of the most memorable things, because it fills a room.
It's so like amazing.
50 feet long.
Yeah.
Something. Yeah.
But that, you know, knowing that this is his work. You know, maybe I would switch the signage to talk about him, and maybe at least update them with more current ideas around anthropology. And
right.
Because there is definitely an evolutionary feel there, and also some weird projections onto the people who are whose things are exhibited there. But as a sort of historical look at that moment in anthropology. And there's some really beautiful things there.
Yeah.
I can imagine a way to preserve that wing and not have it be as offensive. But so maybe I would change it. But learning that he was part of that, even curating and creating the content, just did make me be like, well, okay. Like,
and maybe think about it differently, like that, to know that he, that he was the curator of all of that. It's almost like that part of the museum is a museum exhibiting a certain kind of anthropology.
Right, right. Like, what's like, what's to be studied there is not actually those people.
It's kind of like preserving an older form of anthropology.
Totally, totally. Yeah.
It's, more than, maybe at this point, even maybe more than actually the cultures that are being on display.
That is probably true. That is probably true.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because when we were there, we got to meet, not in that wing, we were in other wings. We got to meet these people who were volunteers who wore these buttons that said explainer on them.
Oh, yeah.
And we got to meet this amazing explainer who was an elderly gentleman who was hanging out with this big piece, hunk of meteorite, which actually came from the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, it came from a creek in Oregon.
And they had moved there. It has a name, and I can't remember the name.
Right.
I mean, in the from the indigenous folks whose land it was taken from.
This was like in the opposite side of the building in a very modern wing.
Yes, absolutely. The very modern,
very up-to-date
astronomy wing.
Astronomy wing with lots of like screens and animated things and all this
stuff. Yeah, for sure.
Right.
But the explainer, oh, he was so excited about that meteorite. And
yeah, it was like, maybe some of y'all know the thing we're talking about here. It's like a hunk of iron that, you know, fell to the earth at some point and was like hauled out of a creek bed, I think in Oregon. And yeah, for the indigenous folks, I wish I knew which indigenous nation we're talking about here, but the indigenous folks there, like they like knew of the meteorite and have for a long time and consider it to be an object very special to them, and there was like a pretty big assault that this was like taken away.
I think they're asking for it back.
And I think that they're trying to get it back. Yeah, but the explainer was really just excited about the scientific astronomical kind
That's
of
a giant
of it.
Hunk of sky iron.
Yeah,
it's
and
very
he'd
big.
Say we're getting way off track. Yeah, but the guy was like, I mean, it's funny because you're the explainer who's posted up next to a lump. Just a metal lump, you know? It's not the most eye-catching thing in the building or even in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, hey, come over here. Touch this, you know? And I'm like, touched it. And he's like, that's the oldest thing you'll ever touch.
Yeah.
And I remember that because it's because meteorites composed of solid iron like that were formed inside of stars. Like, and it would be like, kind of the first generation of stars in the universe that had formed, and then when those stars died out and supernovaed and exploded, the iron chunks got like thrown out into space is the way that I understood this, and one of them collided with our planet as it was going through space.
I mean,
so it's older than the Earth,
older than the Earth. And I will say that I was very moved by touching that piece of sky iron.
It's
a really moving experience. And yes, I hope that it is returned to the people who once tended the area around it. But at the same time, if you're nearby, you might want to go see it and touch it because it's pretty amazing.
It's the oldest thing you'll ever touch.
All this being said, when we were in the anthropology section looking at these archaic and outdated exhibits, we were like, if we lived near here, we would make ourselves fake explainer buttons.
Oh, yeah.
And sneak
this
up.
This is where you were going.
Yes, this is where I was going. And sneak up there and like explain to people like the real deal in anthropology.
Yeah.
And be like, that would be our hobby.
Uh-huh.
I love picturing like alternate Janet and Dave who get to live in New York and have time to go pretend to be
that
official
be
explainers.
Oh, man, there's so much good stuff like that you can do if you lived in New York City. Yeah.
Anyway.
Be like a gorilla explainer.
Yeah, absolutely.
No.
We'll be like, here's everything that's wrong about this exhibit and how this is some settler colonial propaganda happening within this.
Yeah. But also let me tell you about Franz Boas, who was kind of cool guy.
Absolutely.
And blah, blah, and like advancing anthropology in these certain ways. I don't want to leave y'all with the feeling that like Franz Boas is somehow like uniquely guilty of being like a racist anthropologist guy or something. In fact, he was
anti-racist. Yes.
Than a lot of his colleagues at the time. And he worked at in a time period where a lot of just, I mean, a lot of intellectuals in America were drawn towards eugenics.
Mm-hmm. Including his protege.
Including his protege. This is talked about in the book a little bit, you know, and he was like, get me away from
this.
They
had a big split. And that's important just to say, too, that even the culture areas sort of emerged for anthropologists to get away from Ranking. Mm-hmm. His protege, Whistler, whose first name I can't remember, mm-hmm. actually tried to bring it back into a hierarchical domination story with white Europeans on top, mm-hmm. and was sort of curating culture area discussion in that direction. And so he also worked at the museum, mm-hmm. and they had a really big split and falling out that was irreparable. And maybe he's partially responsible for the signage. Like, I don't know, because they both worked there.
Yeah.
I do want to add one thing that I learned about Boas recently, which made me appreciate him even more. And it's that he was the academic advisor for Zora Neale Hurston.
Oh, yeah.
Because she, in case folks don't know, was an amazing ethnographer, a very talented anthropologist.
Yeah.
And has books out that we should link to in the show notes. Her anthropology books are sometimes less known maybe than her fiction. Mm-hmm. But Zora Neale Hurston did excellent work, ethnographic work, both in Haiti and in the Deep South and African American communities, and with root workers and conjure workers in the Southeast, around the coast, and also in Florida. And she's definitely someone that you should look into if you're interested in that kind of lore in the communities that were living in those areas and practicing different folk magic ways. Such fascinating work. And he supported her. He was pretty inspired by her work and held her up. He highlighted her and held her up as how things should be done. And he encouraged her to go get in the field and really work with folks.
Yeah.
And she, because she's African-American, had more access than a lot of the other anthropologists would have had into both the voodoo culture, in the culture of voodoo practitioners in Haiti, but also those folk magic practitioners of hoodoo in the Southeast.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because, yeah, I forgot that he was her advisor.
It's so cool to picture that, right? These two great minds coming together and inspiring each other. And
And not everybody even knows that she was a trained anthropologist.
Yeah, totally. She went to, it was at Columbia University.
That's
right.
Yep. So, all right, we're...
We've gone to the. We talked about meteorites. We've talked about Zora Neale Hurston.
We're gonna leave the museum. we're gonna exit through the gift shop, and return to what were we talking about? This idea of culture areas, right? But yeah, wondering about all of this, you know, anthropologists like wondering about cultural differentiation. What makes cultures similar to each other, who are maybe neighbors, or you know, or different from each other, who are maybe also maybe neighbors? Like, what features they have in common, what features they don't have in common, you know, what a culture adopts from their neighbor and what they don't, was really a preoccupation of the discipline of anthropology for many decades. According to the Davids, it's less so now. But they even talk about an era in anthropology when it was fashionable to isolate out a feature of culture that you could imagine was not really strongly tied to other elements of the culture. Like their example is string figures, you know, how there's all this like ancient anthropological literature about the transmission of string figures, right? You know, like the shapes that you can make like cat's cradles and stuff like with your fingers, and people trying to map, you know, who had such and such a figure. And like, what does it mean, you know, like looking at the map and trying to imagine how the figure could have been like transmitted, you know, how could it have gotten from like this island chain to this other one and all of this stuff. And, you know, this becoming the idea kind of being that like string figures don't matter the same way that a particular kind of tool for processing grain or whatever matters. And so it's kind of, you can make a map of just like pure cultural diffusion, you know? So whatever, like this is kind of interesting to think about, you know, anthropologists trying to create theories about cultural transmission. And if you want to engage with like a really interesting and pretty far out take on string figures, then you can go to season one where we talk about Donna Haraway and Staying with the Trouble, because there's a whole chapter in there that's not just about string figures, but that's like kind of the organizing theme of the chapter.
Yeah, I was thinking about that chapter when they're like, no one really talks about this anymore. And I'm like, well, that's not true.
Yeah. That was actually, the string figures in the Haraway book was actually one of my favorite concepts in the book, because she uses it as kind of like a ontological model of reality. Totally. Like a string figure could be one.
Yeah.
And then like you can make another one.
Right.
And you can pass them along and communicate string figures to other people, because like some of the string figures are meant to be like passed to a partner's hands, and then mm-hmm. they change it and they hand it back to you.
Right.
You know, and so she like riffs on all of this in a very Haraway-ian
right.
type of way. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, oh, but there are people talking about it.
Yeah, right. So interestingly, string figures now come up in 2 out of 3 seasons on The Book on Fire.
There were no string fingers in Caliban and the Witch.
No, there were no string fingers. You're right. So into all of this comes one of the David's favorite protagonists of the book.
Oh, yeah.
Marcel Mauss,
mm-hmm.
another classic anthropologist from 100 years ago.
Friend of the Davids.
Friend of the Davids, Marcel Mauss. You might remember Marcel Mauss from Seasonal Variation of the Eskimo, which was discussed in Chapter 3. And I love this entrance of Mauss into the book.
Mm-hmm.
I remember this well from the first time I read the book. I was like, go Mauss. I don't know. I was really into this that I'm like about to describe. So basically, Mauss's like disruptive, like novel contribution to all of these like debates and investigations was to assert that we should begin by assuming
mm-hmm.
that any culture in question is gonna know about what everybody near them was doing.
Right.
And will have had a chance to adopt those cultural practices, you know. And by near them, even, you know, up to a month or two's journey away.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So like half a continent away, maybe, well, depending on the size of the continent, I guess. We should assume, not that like a cultural feature, you know, like a food recipe or a particular string figure, when it like reaches a certain people living in one particular geographic place, that it's achieved like a noteworthy act of transmission,
mm-hmm.
you know, to have like hopped from one thing to another. But no, but that people actually circulate around.
Mm-hmm.
People are not isolated. And especially in prehistory, one of the refrains of this book is that by some standards of measure, we, like modern people, actually travel less than prehistoric people. And by prehistoric, I'm also including like pre-contact indigenous Americans, whatever, right? So travel was the norm. Cultural interaction, even over wide areas, was the norm. We should assume that people knew about what each other were doing and that there was plenty of opportunities for people to adopt stuff from a wide geographical spread.
Yeah, I was thinking that part of what he's talking about is that even if you or someone you know hadn't traveled those weeks away to be around another culture, you would be a community with someone who had.
Yeah.
And the stories move and the special items move. And I don't know, it's reminding me of the first episode maybe or second of this season, because I was thinking about how European settlers were really surprised to see macaw feathers in around the Great Lakes region,
right,
as special items that were being traded. Macaw feathers from Central and South America,
right? The birds live in South America.
The birds are tropical birds,
right?
But they were in not huge abundance, but special items that were kept and traded and given away,
right,
in that far north.
Right, right. And maybe a person from South America did not make the journey all the way up to the Great Lakes. Of course, it could have been handed hand to hand, you know, all the way there. But it's still evidence of cultural interaction over really, really wide
large distances. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so if we're going to follow Mouse and assume that people are going to know about what each other are up to over big geographical areas, then why then do not all of the cultures kind of like mush into one homogenous thing, right? Just like the best of the practices or whatever, like rise to the top or something, and then everyone ends up kind of doing about the same thing. Well, Mouse proposed that it's because people actually consciously define themselves against each other, you know, like we, like part of our identity, I'm just like putting myself in the shoes of somebody random who's like part of a culture that has like kind of an identity and a coherence to it. Part of what makes us this kind of person is that we are similar to those people over there, but we don't do this thing that they do.
Right.
You know, like we are the people, like one of the examples that they do in the book is like, we are the people who, we use chopsticks. They use forks, you know, and it's not necessarily that there's some like objective technological like reason why, you know, that tool is better for the kinds of foods that we're like eating or something like that. But it's like maybe there's an arbitrariness to it that signifies just the choice to be different. Right.
Well, they bring up in this chapter or something you already talked about a few episodes ago, which is funny. And I think it's true that like we have little vestigial memories from this book.
Yeah, I end up I end up predicting things that are going to be coming.
Yeah, it's happened a few times. But when you were talking about Mouse actually giving examples of people not even adopting technologies that would make their lives easier.
Yeah, sometimes you see that.
You know?
Right. Yeah. And Mouse's example of that, and yeah, I did talk about this when we were talking about the seasonal variability thing in our discussion of chapter 3. And according to Mouse, anyway, the Inuit kayaks were just an objectively superior
boat
type of boat to the boats that like their Athabascan neighbors used. But the Athabascans just stuck to their boats because they were basically like, that's an Eskimo thing. Like, that's not our kind of boat, you know, even though it might have made their lives better. And there's a reciprocal thing where the Inuit did not adopt the Athabascan snowshoes, even though it would have given them some more flexibility as far as their hunting strategies and stuff to have snowshoes as one of their possible technologies that they could use, you know, because they're like, no, we wear these kind of boots.
Yeah.
You know, so there is like sometimes this desire to set oneself off from one's neighbors can actually like, you know, go kind of potentially against the grain of what might be the optimal thing, you know, from a more objective standpoint.
Yeah. And you're also reminding me of how they talk about how a lot of the names like Eskimo that settlers first recorded of different peoples were names their neighbors called them, and they were often slurs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Eskimo meant those folks that don't cook their food or don't cook their meat.
Don't cook their fish or something. Yeah, right.
While Iroquois or Iroquois, depending on whether or not you're using the French pronunciation, would be like those like bloodthirsty killers.
Yeah, right.
You know? Right. And so this is why the names that settlers recorded for people weren't usually the names that the people called themselves, because as the Davids point out, like usually the indigenous groups of people just called themselves like the people. Like we are the people in their language.
Yeah.
Like whatever the original peoples are, because they weren't describing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Right. And like their neighbors are known by something that they think was like kind of funny about them.
Right. Absolutely.
Or like made them different.
Yeah, or made them different.
You know, from themselves, or that they at least saw as being different than themselves.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know. It's interesting that even some of the vestigial terms for different groups of people are about this very difference that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. One of the things that all of this really reminds me of in a funny way is like kind of cultural rivalry or animosity or something between punks and hippies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Between punks and hippies. And specifically, I'm thinking back to like living in Asheville, North Carolina, and living in a punk house in the late 90s. And this was a town that was full of hippies and had like, I mean, it's kind of more of a hippie town, but there was a punk scene there too. Mm-hmm. I mean, there still is. And we were immersed in the punk scene, but it was kind of a small town.
At that point, yeah.
At that point, it felt like kind of a small town, you know, to where there were some more like hippie types that were in our kind of extended circle too. Mm-hmm. And I remember having like these conversations with some of the more like philosophically maybe inclined like punks or hippies about like why we have to kind of be enemies or something. Like why do punks and hippies have to like hate each other? You know, because like we both are kind of like dropout cultures in a certain way, like have problems with conformity and like the mainstream way. Like we both want to stick it to the man. We both are, you know, kind of dirty or whatever, like have, you know, there's like some things you would imagine that like punks and hippies could be allies or something. And we were sometimes. I mean, yeah, like a lot of like some of like the organizing and stuff that was happening at the time would involve members of both groups. But still culturally, it was, you know, like the punks that we hung out with, even the ones who were like into organic food and kind of crunchy and wanted to buy land and move out to the woods and stuff, who were doing kind of hippie stuff, were like, it was very important that they not be perceived as hippies, and they talk shit about hippies all the time.
And hippie was a slur.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, right. Like if somebody, yeah, you'd be like, oh, you fucking hippie or whatever. It was like, it was definitely, yes, exactly.
It was a slur.
But,
And we would try to be like, well, what is the difference? I mean, like, why am I not a hippie? And like, also to the outside world, we were just hippies.
Yeah. Yeah, right. For sure. Like it was right. Yeah. Especially to like older generations of people.
Yes.
For sure. But there is this like, you know, I mean, it kind of doesn't fit because punks and hippies were both kind of created.
Yes.
Organically out of certain cultural milieus. I mean, that's not totally true. I think to some extent, punk was a reaction to hippie.
Right.
So maybe there is like, we haven't used the word schismogenesis yet in the podcast, but we're going there in the chapter. So maybe there is a little bit of a schismogenetic origin story there.
Mm-hmm.
But if not schismogenesis, like a group sort of being born out of the refusal of another group's way of doing things,
right,
there was at least like an identity thing about sticking to ways that set you apart from the other.
Mm-hmm.
Like if it's ways of dress, like ways of talking, you know, like lingo, you know, like cultural identity. And part of the identity is like based around that we're not that,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
And so then like there's like a reluctance to like approach the things that would maybe allow you to be confused with the thing that you're invested in not being
mm-hmm.
too, you know? So like the boundary becomes something that's like asserted.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because one of the things Mauss pointed out is that a lot of times cultural identity is defined as much in negation in what you are not as it is in what you are.
Right. Yeah. You know? That's the point. I guess I haven't said that yet, but like cultures are born of refusal.
Right.
Refusal, you know, and this, it will become a very big idea in the Dawn of Everything. I mean, we're a lot of the ways into the Dawn of Everything, but this is a big idea in the book.
Yeah.
And there's even, I wanted to read this short quote where it's from Mauss himself. He says, societies live by borrowing from each other, but they define themselves rather by the refusal of borrowing than by its acceptance. Mm. Yeah. So it's not that the borrowing is non-existent, but it's not by what's borrowed and shared that they define themselves.
Right.
They define themselves by kind of what they don't share with their neighbors, you know. And in the case of like hippies and punks, it's maybe like cultural neighbors, although sometimes maybe geographic neighbors too, like maybe the house next to you is a hippie house.
Right. But, or like, we're not going to borrow these very long songs that don't seem to be going anywhere.
Right.
Okay. We're not borrowing that.
Long noodling guitar solos.
Yeah. We will borrow the organic food.
Right. So just to wrap this up. So Mauss contributes this idea, you know, of that, like, actually, we should be looking less at how things spread.
Right.
You know, and treating the spread of things as something special that we need to track.
Right.
We should just assume universal spread. And therefore, cultural differentiation is more likely to be about the refusal to adopt a practice.
Right.
The decision not to adopt a practice.
Yeah, and so they're going to apply this idea, which, wait, have you defined schismogenesis now?
No.
Okay. So to be more specific here, the term that they use that Mauss maybe coined, did he coin the term schismogenesis?
The term comes from Gregory Bateson.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, the term comes from Bateson, who I learned about mainly actually from the writings of Deleuze and Guattari.
Oh, right.
But he also seems, to, he apparently coined this term schismogenesis, which, you know, so like a schism. We know what that is. And then genesis is like the origin of something. So the term, like, basically it takes this idea of, you know, refusal and cultural differentiation based on refusal and actually develops it kind of further to speak about how, like, the origin of a culture could be in the refusal of something important that they're wanting to disavow.
Right. Or more broadly, like how societies that are in contact with each other define themselves in contrast to each other. Because part of what they're wanting to point out here too is that sometimes there's a reaction between the two. Like it's a couple of cultures defining themselves both by what they are not.
Yeah, that's true too.
So,
right.
You know, so there's also like a sort of becoming more of yourself through relief.
Yeah, that's true.
In contrast,
too.
You know?
Yeah, like it might not go back to like the origin,
the very
of the
beginning,
culture or something,
I think,
but
it's becoming.
It feeds into the endless process of becoming, you know, because all cultures are changing.
Right.
All cultures are always in flux. So that's schismogenesis.
So that's what schismogenesis is. And then we're going to spend a lot of the rest of the chapter talking about the schismogenesis, or what they're saying, the place of schismogenesis and the differences between the cultures of two culture areas on the west coast of Turtle Island, which anthropologists tend to divide up into the Northwest coastal peoples and the Californian peoples. Even though there's a pretty wide variety of folks in both regions, different cultures, different languages, as you already mentioning. But generally, there's enough in common that the broad stroke cultural areas are divided up into those two parts.
Yeah, this was really interesting to read about, not having known about this anthropology really at all. I mean, I'd heard of some of the groups, of course, that were involved, and I knew a little bit about some of their practices and stuff. But just that it's even common in anthropology to just talk about California,
right,
like indigenous California, as sort of one cultural sphere. And then everybody to the north on the coast is another.
Right.
And they even talk about how, like, I think it's like the Yurok people who sort of like stand in mm-hmm. for a lot of their neighbors.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And to the north, the people who are called like the Kwak Kwak Kwak,
yeah.
who are in anthropology are often known as the Kwak Yutl, but mm-hmm. apparently that's not the right name for them. The right name is actually the Kwak Kwak Kwak.
Mm-hmm.
And, but those people are just one people from mm-hmm. the Northwest Coast, but they're kind of used as the exemplar of this whole,
yeah.
of this whole sphere that went from Southern Oregon, or at least Middle Oregon or something, mm-hmm. all the way up to so what's now Alaska.
Alaska, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're going to be comparing and contrasting these broad groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we're going to get into some pretty detailed ethnography or ethnographical information here. The Northwest people, we've already discussed somewhat, the coastal Northwest folks, the Kwakiutl or Kwak 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 people. And this was a lifeway, and still is, that was largely based around salmon.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time of contact, salmon was the primary food source or sort of organizing principle of life in a lot of ways. These folks were sedentary. They had access to waterways and salmon runs that they protected and kept. And they are very well known for their art. When we talked about the canoe, big war canoe that right. is in the Museum of Natural History.
It is amazingly carved.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very beautiful. So a lot of art, a lot of time spent on creating art, turning those coniferous trees up in the Northwest into beautiful things, totem poles and sculptures and canoes. And they had a sort of warrior aristocracy
mm-hmm.
or something that looks like that.
Right.
Where they would do warring raids on people. That's going to be very important to what we're going to get into later. But they had a aristocracy where different chiefs would vie for the loyalty of the commoners, of their own people.
Right.
And to do this, they had these very elaborate feasts called potlatches. And at the potlatch, so there's an interesting part here where only the aristocratic royalty chief people had access to these guardian spirits who gave them aristocratic titles.
Mm.
And when you got one of these titles, which you would get one a few times in your life, and I don't know how this happened or what the process was, but
right.
they were the ones who had ritual access to the guardian spirits
mm-hmm.
who conferred these titles. But when you got one of these titles, then you would have this elaborate feast where people would eat an incredible amount of fish. You would just have piles of salmon and ulacan. Is that the other one?
Yeah, there's another anadromous fish
yeah.
that I was like relatively unfamiliar with called ulacan
mm-hmm.
that comes up, which are, I think, more in the north.
Okay.
Like when you get into California, there's not
no ulacan.
They're yeah. also called candlefish.
Right. So candlefish.
Very
oily and
greasy.
Fatty.
Yeah.
Right. So they would have these very elaborate and plentiful to excess, Epicurean even, feasts.
Grease feasts. Uh-huh.
And would like rub oil on themselves and pour oil on the fire and give a, just redistribute wealth
mm-hmm.
between everyone amongst your subjects.
Yeah, right.
And so the potlatch, which we're going to talk about that a little bit more in a bit, was a key feature there.
Right.
And there was definitely much pride in ancestry
right.
and sort of like self-aggrandizing speech and being like, my lineage is so great and I am very powerful. And they talk about the chiefs talking about being like great mountains of which boulders of gifts roll down onto their little people to help them.
Right.
So that's the coastal Northwest.
So you get the sense of like this culture of great material abundance,
yes.
right? Like these rivers that are famously just teem with salmon
mm-hmm.
that supports this really elaborate material culture
mm-hmm.
and
sort of ostentatious.
I've always gotten yeah. the feeling of this sense of like such great fortune to mm-hmm. be so well endowed with such like abundance
mm-hmm.
that it kind of erupts in this culture of like excess
mm-hmm.
and kind of, yeah, just like, you know, throwing the fish oil onto the fire just to make big flames,
right.
to make an ostentatious display. Right. Like there's just so much kind of like Bataillon excess and kind of squandering or something
mm-hmm.
in a way. Anyway, that's at least kind of like the cartoon image
yeah.
that I've always sort of had
yeah.
about these like potlatch feasts and this kind of culture in general, that it's sort of, it's it's part and parcel with just these like teeming rivers of salmon and just more than you could possibly harvest and mm-hmm. all of that.
Yeah. And importantly, I want to just define a term before we move on. And I know we're going to talk about this more later, but anadromous is the word Dave used to refer to the fish.
Mm.
And this word means fish that return to where they were spawned to spawn again at that point in their life. So they've gone out to the salmon famously go out to the ocean yeah. for their adult life after they come up as little small fry in the rivers. And then they swim back upstream against the current. Hopefully, you know, this is pre lots of dams all over those rivers.
Yeah.
And they swim back in. And at this point, many people and observers of that time who recorded this talk about how there were so many fish you couldn't even see the water sometimes.
Right.
You know, so we're talking about a sort of unfathomable, or at least at this point, unfathomable with the level of extraction that's happened up until this point of fish around the world.
Right.
So much fish.
Yeah.
And salmon, just if you've ever gotten to eat like fresh raw salmon, it's just such an amazing, rich, buttery, delicious yeah. treat, you know?
Right. And there's the greatest diversity of salmon.
Right.
Many, many species of salmon, but salmon are not the only anadromous fish of the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
There's also steelheads and
right,
sturgeons.
Right. Steelhead trout.
Eulachon. Yeah. And then, you know, there's these other ones too that are in mm-hmm. the mix, but salmon are, you know, the most well-known, and I think the most plentiful.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's what the coastal Northwest Coast people's sort of culture was based around. Also, I would add that a lot of the settler observers and anthropologists talked about their elaborate theater. They're super into theater. They would have these elaborate masks, masks within masks, and would have like trap doors in the stage and all these special effects. Like they were really into theater with effects. And they had these like violent clown police, which I thought that part was kind of funny. That was a staple of their theater going yeah. time. But yeah, they had very elaborate theater that was part of this gathering together that they did in the winter. This is more of like a winter thing.
Okay.
But so it's going to be important again that just to go back to the anadromous part, we're going to talk about it when we get more into what life is based around later, but this is a lot of fish that all come together at one time. The fishing season is like a finite amount of time. You can probably fish a lot of the year, but that huge abundance is very specifically when the fish are coming back to spawn.
Right.
So
yeah. So you've got to get what you can then.
Right then.
And then make it last.
Right. So again, we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
Further south, the culture of, yes, the Yurok, are sometimes standing in for a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to do too much broad stroke, but I will say that I'm just going to try to be basing what I'm talking about, what they're talking about in the book right now. So, yeah.
And the book is a little confusing.
Yes.
Like you can read the chapter a couple different times and it's still sort of like, wait, are they talking about the Yurok in this part? Or are they talking about more than that? Are they talking about Northwest Californians or
right.
are they talking about all of California?
Right.
Or does the Central Valley and the Pimo and stuff, are they part of this too? Or are they not? And to be fair to us, like the readers who are just trying to navigate this or whatever, the book is like sometimes frustratingly a little bit vague, or it jumps back and forth mm-hmm. enough between who's getting talked
they're
about.
They're not always very specific that. About who they're talking about.
Yeah.
And that's definitely one of the criticism that anthropologists who do field work in that region or have talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, I will say here that a lot of the different anthropologists who responded to a chapter that was released before this book, or a paper that was similar to this mm-hmm. chapter that was released before the book was released, had some good things to say and appreciated the analysis of schismogenesis. They just thought that they were lumping groups of people together too much.
Uh-huh.
So.
Right, right.
Just to say.
Yeah.
But
Jane and I were able to read, there was an issue of an anthropology journal,
right.
like an academic journal, where an early version of this chapter was published in the journal. And it was like a round table where mm-hmm. they invited anthropologists who work in this area to write short responses and reactions to the chapter. And mm-hmm. that's what we
right,
read.
Right, right,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we're just going to say Californians for what they're talking about right now, because it's a broad stroke. This is a big picture
yeah.
panning out
we're
a little bit.
We're going to present it kind of the way they're presenting.
Right.
Yes.
So the Californians who were living further south from those coastal peoples of the Northwest, they had, as we mentioned already, a really wide array of plant communities and food sources. They relied less heavily on fish. They used a lot more tree nuts, or worked with tree nuts a lot more and stored tree nuts more. I think also partially from meeting that anthropology roundtable, I learned that these people also ate a lot, like hunted deer, collected abalone and other shellfish. There was a more diverse diet, basically.
Yeah.
In general. But culturally, there's some pretty significant differences in the way these folks further south lived as well. And I'm going to describe them first before I actually talk about the comparison. But the folks further south, we know a lot more about, we know about largely, or at least initially, from the work of a man, an anthropologist named Walter Goldschmidt. And he studied the Yurok and other sort of related groups in Northern California. And Goldschmidt was super interested in the Yurok, and as were other anthropologists after this his piece came out, because they actually had money. And, you know, we've talked about already earlier in the book how settlers love to project the concept of money onto different special items from different indigenous groups.
Yeah.
But in this case, it really worked like money. They had shells.
Yeah, this was fascinating.
Yeah, this stuff is really interesting.
So I was like, really, though? Really?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, but go ahead.
But they had, so they had these like white dentalium shells on strings sometimes. They had headbands made of woodpecker scalps, and both of those worked like money. And actually could be used to purchase things. It could be used for rental. It could be used for loans. I have no idea what people were renting.
You could maybe buy land.
Yes.
Even with it. Yeah.
You could be in debt.
Right.
And pay it back.
Yeah.
You know, it really wasn't like we're going to project the concept of money onto these things that people are only used to gamble. Or collected in a dream from a dream or something, you know,
right.
Actually
it only has one purpose, which is to like buy your initiation into a secret society or something. Right. Because that's what you see sometimes with these like kind of proto money type of things.
And also there's some interesting parts of this chapter where, at least according to Goldschmidt, not only did they have money, but money was very important to them, like actually sacred in a way. And aristocrats, or at least like the wealthier people, would actually like sit and meditate on money. It had a very strange place in the culture, which I suppose that people do today in a different way. But but Goldschmidt.
But didn't they also say that when you died, all your money would be destroyed?
Some of the cultures did that.
Okay.
Some of them could inherit wealth.
Okay. Okay.
And so because part of what's really interesting about the Yurok and some of the cultures around them was that there was an emphasis on individual worth based on hard work and merit, like sort of the idealized version of capitalism that we have, where people like pull themselves up from their bootstraps and earn their way in the world. Even people who did inherit wealth would work very hard to say, like, these are the ways I earned this.
Yeah.
Because that was part of their ethic. And this is part of what led...
Sounds familiar.
Yes. Yes, it does. But I think that this maybe might have been a little more accurate than the fantasies of Nepo babies today or something. But you like that I pulled out Nepo babies?
What is... I've never heard this.
What? No. Oh, nepotism. It's like...
I wondered if that was...
Yeah, it comes from nepotism. It's like if you only got where you are because your parent is famous or rich or something.
Nepo baby.
I'm embarrassed.
I'm learning over here.
Anyway, back to the story. Goldschmidt is like this kind of cluster of things. So like individual... getting there through hard work, self-actualization through work. All of this is part of what led Goldschmidt to compare the Yurok and the surrounding cultures with the ideas of the Protestants in Max Weber's The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. Is that what it's called?
That is what it's called, yeah. Right.
So obviously, there's some issues with that comparison. However, there are some interesting things.
There's bound to be.
Yes.
We can just assume from the outset that there's some issues with
that comparison.
Yeah.
However, what people did notice who were studying the Yurok was that there was this emphasis on hard work. There was a disdain for indulgence of any kind. Like, you weren't supposed to overdo it with food. You shouldn't overdo it with sex. Simple plain foods were celebrated. People were exhorted to become to stay thin and lithe and never to overeat.
Mm-hmm.
The men had these daily sweat lodges that you had to crawl through a hole to get into. And it was like a daily test of whether or not you were eating too much.
Yeah.
Because there was such a preference, I mean, such an emphasis on staying thin.
Mm-hmm.
When they did have big feasts, because they did have feasts, group feasts that sort of worked to redistribute wealth a little bit, they would emphasize plain and simple foods.
Right.
You know, and they were not into rich cuisine. There were different cuisines for different people of different rank. Also, the Yurok were not very interested in their ancestry because there was less of an emphasis on aristocratic lines or lineage and more of an emphasis on we all show up equal and what you make with yourself in this life is where you are.
Right.
You know, and also sounding familiar. I mean, you can see like why Goldschmidt might have started to be like, this is weird. And I have to acknowledge this is weird for me. Like when I read this, I don't think clearly these are Protestants.
Right.
As they're going to call them later.
Right. Right.
But at the same time, I think that.
I mean, it's also being present. Right. Like we only know this through the words of people who are seeing it this way.
Right. That's true.
As well. So I just want to point that out.
Right. But at the same time, I have a lot of associations with that sort of disdain for indulgence coming from a puritanical background. And so I think that this is a good example of me having to confront my own assumptions about indigenous folks or my own assumptions about people who had not had contact with Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tend to think of a lot of, or hadn't had contact with capitalism.
Yeah.
You know, I think that having grown up Protestant, I have some pretty negative associations with some of the things listed here.
Yeah.
You know, that it's interesting because I'm just like, wait, people could have come up with this in another way?
Yeah, you know? Right. Like, we think of a very specific, like, historical origin for all of this Protestant stuff. And yeah, it is mind-boggling to see, like, that there's a convergence.
Yeah.
Onto this form that maybe it's wrong to call it Protestant, but it at least like has these certain features.
Yeah, yeah. And so just to finish up the description, like the Californians also had theater and had these entertainments that would happen at the feast, but they tended to be much less elaborate and tended to like just have like kind of like comedy about what was happening, like making fun of gender roles or having people switch places, like things like that in their plays.
Yeah.
And if there were special items, they were like moved around.
Sounds like wholesome family.
Very wholesome family humor. But they would also have, you know, if they brought out special items, it would be more about like sharing them and passing them around rather than having like being like, this is my lineage shield.
Right.
You know.
And maybe you're not just like throwing them onto the fire.
And definitely not destroying the special things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if it's not very clear at this point.
Yeah, you can see the schismogenetic contours if you haven't. Maybe you've seen them starting to take shape here.
Right. So we have a society.
Can I just say, I just want to also say that like we have friends who live in California.
Right.
Who have Yurok neighbors and have worked with Yurok people.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I know, I bet there's at least one of them who's listening to this podcast. And I just thought the whole time I was reading through this chapter, I'm like, what would a Yurok person think?
Of this description. Right.
And you know, yeah, I mean, just as like an open question, I'm not even making any assumptions about what they would think. Or like, even if this was like broadly true of the Yurok people when this was recorded, when Goldschmidt was observing this stuff 100, 150 years ago or something, like, are there remnants of these cultural things still happening now?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's just like an open curiosity, but I'm bringing in here just because when I read the word like Yurok, for me, that's not like some people who, you know, I've never heard of who live in Java or something. I have an association and I've been to Yurok territory and I've not met Yurok people as far as I know, but I know people who do or something. And so it feels closer. And so I'm like, what would they think?
And if anybody does know of a Yurok response to this part, please let us know. I don't know who all's reading this book and responding to it.
I wondered that too. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Because
in that direction.
Yeah. Point us in that direction. For sure. Yeah. And just to point out here, one of the cooler things that I've heard about as far as returning to indigenous land management practices I know of is happening in Yurok territory, because you can take classes on fire management from Yurok folks, and that's a really cool opportunity, you know,
right,
to be able to have your land like maintained, or to learn the practices of renewal and of tending, wild tending,
yeah,
from the people who were doing it since time immemorial.
Yeah, right.
So anyway, just to say, I think about that every time I read or listen to this chapter as well. So, okay. Yeah, as you already mentioned, the broad strokes are here. I mean, we see the schismogenesis. These cultures seem to be almost opposite of
polar
each other.
Opposites.
Polar opposites, you know? And they're saying, well, why? Why are they polar opposites? And we're going to get into this more when we talk about their food ways in a bit. But towards the end of this section, they're like, well, so what do we, how do we explain this difference? You know, do people start with an idea, an individual culture? Do the people in that society think this is what humans do and they move out from there? Are they actually creating their whole life constrained by the environmental factors, and that's what determines the culture that emerges? And their technological adaptation to that? Do they have some ideas about how humans should interact with each other? And like, some people are nobles and some people are not. And that's what starts it all. They have a societal organization that is the way things develop. You know, these are some of the ways. See, there's some of the interpretations that people have given up over the years. And so the Davids are like, well, what about schismogenesis? How much about the way these two culture areas, the people within these two culture areas move through the world, are actually in relief and defined against each other? And that's what we're going to be talking about for the rest of the chapter. And for them, for the Davids, they think the answer to this lies in the institution of slavery.
Or that might be a key. That can unlock the whole thing. Maybe I'll also add that another thing that the Davids want to say about this, one of their gripes, is that both of these broad cultural groups, the more northern people who practice potlatch, who they call the Fisher Kings in the chapter, and the Californians to the south, are just lumped together
by
anthropology.
That is important.
Into a single category called affluent foragers or complex foragers. And this is very offensive to them, that people who could be so different are just thought of as the same to anthropology, because they both go in this one same box. And I have mixed feelings actually about that objection, because I'm sure that they're responding to something that is actually real and annoying in anthropology. But I guess I just have another part of me, and you know, I'm just like the novice who's like in the armchair kind of like looking at this stuff, but there's another part of me that's like, well, I mean, to call them both affluent foragers or something is also just to say one thing about them. You know, I think that when I was saying this to you the other day, I was like, it's kind of like pointing out that two people are both Scorpios or something, right? It's like, that's to say one thing about them, but it's not to say everything about them.
It depends who's talking.
But maybe it depends who's talking.
I think for both, for your example and for the affluent forager example, because I think for some people, it would say a lot about someone to make that statement that they're both Scorpios.
I mean, I guess what is really of consequence is what would be like, what do you assume about a culture,
right,
simply on the basis that you have placed them in this category?
And I think
that would be where I would maybe be discerning about it. You know,
I would bet, though, that a lot of people who are reading just about affluent foragers are not picturing a population in which 25% of the people are chattel slaves.
Right.
And that's what we're going to be getting into. You know, I think a lot of lay readers, when they hear affluent forager, don't picture a system of domination in which someone who is captured in a war raid and is a slave has children who also are slaves by birth. You know, so.
Sure. I mean, and most people probably don't, maybe they've never pictured anything around the term affluent forager. You know, okay, okay, maybe they're okay, just encountering okay. it here in the book for the first time.
I mean, I think about all the 100 times I saw the words affluent forager.
Yeah, I mean, sorry. I want to be careful because, like, I'm not here to defend the categories. I mean, I think, like, affluent forager or complex forager, those categories kind of stink. Like, I'm not trying to, like, right. preserve them or whatever. My thought about it is actually, like, it's less superficial than that. It's not just like, hey, the categories are good. It's like, if they're griping that, like, oh, but all these people are just affluent foragers mm-hmm. or something, then the implication is that anthropology is not noticing the differences between them.
Right.
And I just wonder right. if that's actually true.
Sure.
That anthropology is not noticing the difference.
Especially since so much of anthropology these days is about splitting.
Yeah.
You know?
Is about uniquely describing
yes.
peoples. Yeah.
Right. For sure. Uh-huh. But, you know, they do frequently refer to, like, the different branches of anthropology that are more interested in, like, the data collection and the broad strokes and what can we know about people from,
right.
you know, which we're going to get into
uh-huh.
next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true.